paid on the money, even if your the home state passes, because you need those items. You badly need those items on your wedding day. And this is, of course, not the opinion of the other religious authorities. Ayatollah Sistani, for example, says that homes should be paid from the money which you have saved up.
In order to a special purpose.
Yeah, actually. to purchase certain things you need on your wedding day or for your wedding. No matter how much badly you need the money, you should pay homes from it. But Ayatollah Khamenei has a more softer approach. He is lenient and he is flexible when it comes to the wedding expenses. He says that wedding expenses are very costly, and some families do not afford it. And therefore, if they save money for the wedding expenses, and even a year runs over the savings, still they are not supposed to pay homes, provided that the money is used to buy something within a few days. You know. Within several days of the week or the month, you know, and it should not be kept there in the savings account for another year. Otherwise, that quite suggests that he or she did not need it in the first place.
Uh-huh. And the purpose is important for wedding.
Yeah, for wedding, of course.
It is permissible, actually.
It is permissible to keep it.
Not for any other purpose.
Purposes,
actually.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, dear Sheikh Javed, for your nice answers. And thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can follow us on social media. Just type Call of Islam Radio. Until our next episode, fi amanallah and goodbye.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As-salamu alayk ya Aba Abdullah.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the grandson of the esteemed and honorable Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards salvation and prosperity, the one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura, saying, "In so many difficulties and sorrows, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances before you, O Allah. This is because I lean on you and I am inclined towards you. I tend towards no other." Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Hussein's words in the afternoon of Ta'suwa. I dreamt of the Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad, may Allah bless him and his progeny, who told me, "You are returning to us very shortly. O my dear brother, may my soul be sacrificed for you. Ride on your horse to meet them and ask them of their purpose and incentive, and inquire of any news that they have received. Return to them, and if you can, delay them until early next morning, and get tonight as respite, so that we will be performing salah for our Lord. Tonight, we will appeal to Allah and ask Allah's forgiveness, for Allah knows that I do adore the salah. And reciting his book, the Holy Quran, and profusion of supplications, and seeking forgiveness."
As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifina'i alayka.
Dear audience, now let's listen to some parts of Ziyara An-Nahiya Al-Muqaddasa. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala al-Husayn alladhi samihat nafsuhu bimuhjati.
Peace be upon al-Husayn, who sacrificed himself up to the last drops of the blood of his heart.
As-salamu ala man ata'a Allah fi sirrihi wa alaniyatihi.
Peace be upon him who obeyed Allah secretly and openly.
As-salamu ala man ja'ala Allah shifaa fi turbatihi.
Peace be upon whom Allah placed a cure in the soul of his place of martyrdom.
السلام على من الإجابة تحت قبتي.
Peace be upon the one under whose dome answer to supplications is guaranteed.
السلام على من الأئمة من ذريتي.
Peace be upon the one in whose descendants are the imams after him.
السلام على ابن خاتم الأنبياء. السلام على ابن سيد الأوصياء.
Peace be upon the son of the seal of the prophets. Peace be upon the son of the chief of the executors.
السلام على ابن فاطمة الزهراء. السلام على ابن خديجة الكبرى.
Peace be upon the son of Fatima, the radiant. Peace be upon the son of Khadija, the great.
السلام على ابن سدرة المنتهى. السلام على ابن جنة المأوى. السلام على ابن زمزم والصفا.
Peace be upon the son of the low tree in the outermost boundary of heaven. Peace be upon the son of the garden of refuge. Peace be upon the son of Zamzam and As-Safa.
As-salamu ala al-murammali bid-dima. As-salamu ala al-mahduki al-khiba. As-salamu ala khamisi ashabi ahli al-kasa.
Peace be upon him who was saturated in his blood. Peace be upon him whose tents were violated. Peace be upon the fifth of the people of the cloak.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa binasta'in. Assalamu alaykum wa abdullah. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is an episode of the program Dialogue, and I'm Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, explaining some aspects of the discourses of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam. When Imam al-Hussein al-Salam and his companions spent some days in Karbala, and little by little, the Umayyad hegemony sent more and more military forces, soldiers, to Karbala in order to seize Imam al-Hussein al-Salam. And then on the ninth day of Muharram, that is on the day Tasu'a, the ninth day of Muharram, it was in the afternoon that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam understood that the Umayyad army intended to launch an attack, in fact a large skirmish, on the camp of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam. Then Imam al-Hussein al-Salam dispatched his stepbrother, his younger stepbrother Al-Abbas ibn Ali, Hazrat Abu al-Fath salamullah alayhi, to go and talk with the enemy soldiers and to request some respite, I mean, only for that night, for the following night, that is on the for the eve of Ashura. Then Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam indicated in this way to his youngest stepbrother Al-Abbas ibn Ali that the reason for requesting that respite would be that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam wanted to spend the whole night on performing salat and offering prayers and offering his repentance to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. From this indication of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we understand that when it was the end of the mission of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and in fact when he noticed that he was approaching his certain martyrdom, he never sought respite in order to live longer, or for example to spend one more day in this world. Rather, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam intended to spend the last night of his life all on prayer, on reciting the Holy Quran, and he wanted to get as closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as possible. The camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the eve of Ashura was all busy with performing salat or reciting the Holy Quran. On the other hand, the other camp, the camp of the Umayyads, were all busy with their own businesses, with their merrymaking, because they knew well that on the ensuing day, they would be the winners of the battle and the victor and the whole military clashes. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum ya Aba Abdillah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
عليك مني
Limelight. Records show the U.S. government has retrieved highly sensitive materials from former President Donald Trump on three separate occasions. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, "Trump's Stash Retrieved from Mar-a-Lago Runs to Hundreds of Classified Files." Former U.S. President Donald Trump has turned over to the government hundreds of documents marked as classified and improperly retained at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, according to a review conducted by the National Archives, the custodian of presidential records, and sources familiar with the matter. The U.S. government has retrieved highly sensitive materials on three separate occasions. One set of documents facilitated by the National Archives in January, one set went to the Justice Department in June, and another set was seized by the FBI in a search of Mar-a-Lago 2 weeks ago. An inventory of materials in that initial transfer showed the National Archives recovered from Trump more than 100 documents marked as classified, more than 700 pages in total, and some with special access program markings that designate the highest level of classification. The disclosures, which came in a letter published by one of Donald Trump's liaisons with the National Archives on Tuesday, provides for the first time an official accounting of the volume and the sensitivity of the documents hoarded by the former president since the end of his administration. And it helps to explain why the Justice Department opened a national security investigation into the unauthorized retention of government secrets by Donald Trump that resulted in FBI agents executing a search warrant at his residence at Mar-a-Lago in Florida to recover any remaining official records. The volume and sensitivity of the documents recovered by the National Archives in January also sheds light on the Justice Department's urgency to make repeated visits to the pay-for membership resort and the push to have the FBI gather the materials after months of delay. Donald Trump has pushed back at the FBI, and on Monday, 22nd of August, his lawyers filed a motion seeking the appointment of a so-called special master to determine what seized materials can be used in a potential prosecution on the basis of executive and other privilege, instead of Justice Department filter teams. The motion also asked for a more detailed receipt of what was seized and, as The Guardian earlier reported on Saturday, that a court restricts the Justice Department from reviewing any more of the seized documents until a special master, usually a retired lawyer or a retired judge, is appointed. If the documents are determined to be covered by executive privilege, then while Donald Trump might not be entitled to keep them, they should reside at the National Archives. Trump could have a valid argument that the government cannot use it against him in a prosecution. The argument, according to several former U.S. attorneys, is that the Justice Department should not be able to use in a prosecution any documents that are privileged, but are not subject to the crime fraud exception, which concerns materials which have to do with or is in furtherance of a crime. In essence, the argument goes, there could be materials or communications seized by the FBI that are privileged, but not themselves be used in furtherance of a crime. That even if the Justice Department would like to use in a prosecution, should be excluded from the evidence. According to reporting by The Guardian and others, shortly after opening the investigation, the Justice Department grew concerned that there might be additional classified materials being retained at Mar-a-Lago that they needed to collect, according to sources briefed on the matter. The Justice Department interviewed a number of witnesses and in May issued a subpoena for remaining classified documents. The following month, Jay Bratt, the chief of the counterintelligence section of the agency, and three other officials went to Florida to retrieve the materials. At the June visit, one of Donald Trump's attorneys, Evan Corcoran, sifted through boxes of documents brought from the White House and stacked in a storage area at Mar-a-Lago to identify responsive documents and drafted a statement attesting to what they were giving over to Jay Bratt. The statement was signed by the custodian of records. The custodian is understood to be another Trump lawyer, Christina Bob. Though a person close to Donald Trump declined to confirm or deny whether she was the custodian. But the Justice Department then came across evidence that Donald Trump might be holding on to additional classified documents, including in his office at Mar-a-Lago, the former president's principal residence during the winter until mid-July, when he decamps to his New Jersey golf course. The Justice Department were also alarmed that after it subpoenaed the Trump Organization, which runs the Mar-a-Lago property, on 22nd of June, for security camera footage, including of the hallway directly outside of the storage area, it showed people taking boxes in and out of the area. It was not clear whether the boxes seen on the security camera tape were related to presidential or government records. The New York Times reported that the Justice Department is now also seeking footage from the weeks leading up to the FBI search conducted on Monday, 8th of August. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's rival and fellow Republican, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, joined in on attacking the FBI for searching the former president's Mar-a-Lago resort. Ron DeSantis also released an advertisement attacking the news media.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi one.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, ulama, and authors all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi, and another from the University of Qom, Dr. Fakh Rouhani. Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So in the new series of the program, The Teacher, in the month of Muharram and Safar, we try to dedicate our programs and episodes of the program, The Teacher, to the authors who spend their time in compiling books about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. That's why for today we want to talk about one of the greatest and maybe from among the early generation of the authors who authored and compiled a book regarding the history of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the day of Ashura. He is no one but Abu Mekhnaf. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you, brother. First, give us the background or a little bit biography of Abu Mekhnaf, and then we'll get to his magnum opus, Maqtal al-Husayn.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Abu Mekhnaf, as you mentioned, to be honest, based on his biography, we don't know much. Mm-hmm. Because, as you mentioned, he is regarded as one of the early historians who wrote about Imam Hussein alayhi salam and generally wrote about the Islamic history.
Yes.
So when we refer to the historical records, we see that actually his time span is mentioned from 80,
that's right,
after Hijrah up until 157. So
that's right. Yeah, so he was born,
middle of the second century.
So he was born maybe 90 years after the story of Ashura and Karbala, isn't it?
Based on this historical account. Yes, that's record, right. Okay. It is regard. Yeah, you can consider it that way. That 20 years.
20 years now.
Yes, 20 years.
Yes.
Yes, 20 years after the tragedy of Karbala, he was born.
Okay.
But when we go and refer to the historical books and records, we see that some have regarded him as the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam. Some other have regarded him as the companions of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein. But it is possible to say more reliable.
That's right.
Record that is going to regard him as the companions of Imam Sadiq. And yes, we see this record is more fitting his time span. Why? Because we see that his death time is recorded or is reported as 157, and we have Imam Sadiq being martyred exactly on 148.
Okay,
so almost right. 10 years after the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, he also passed away.
That's all right.
So based on these historical reports, we can say that he is regarded as one of the second century historians,
yes,
who wrote about Imam Hussein's,
that's right,
tragedy. So his report and his record could be regarded as one of the genuine,
that's right,
and very, very fresh record to the tragedy of Karbala.
That's right.
Why we see many historians after him, including Tabari,
yes,
the most important,
yes,
Sunni historian, is going to quote almost the whole chapter of Karbala from his report.
That's all
meaning
right.
that okay. what he has wrote regarding the tragedy of Karbala,
yes,
or has been delivered through the book of Tabari,
yes,
is not the whole historical books or historical records that Abu Mekhnaf has written in this regard.
That's right. Okay. So, Dr. Farhwani, in this way, Abu Mekhtaf is considered as a historiographer, isn't it?
Yes.
A historian, a person who wrote many books and authored so many outstanding manuscripts on the history of Islam, including Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. So you, as a researcher on Ashura literature, how did you find the work of Abu Mekhtaf as the first one? Is it believed to be the first one, isn't it?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I have to thank you and thank Mr. Mahdavi's contributions. In this regard, it must be indicated that among the sources available, among the earliest sources available, Abu Mekhtaf is certainly one of such sources. However, it's believed that he was preceded by a person named Asbagh ibn Nubateh al-Majashi'i.
That's right.
Okay? Asbagh ibn Nubateh, who was a companion of Imam Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam and who was a resident of Kufa, must be in a better situation in order to gather first-hand information from the people who were over there.
That's right. Okay?
However, Asbagh ibn Nubateh was reportedly an old man. He was too old to take part in the battle of Karbala on Ashura.
Okay.
At the same time, it must be indicated that at that time, I mean, rewriting history in the present sense of the term wasn't common. Rather, at that time, I mean, when we look at the books and I mean historical documents indicated, we find that they are either event oriented or personality oriented.
That's right.
That is, for example, Waqat al-Siffin is event. Event-oriented, okay, of Nasr ibn Muzahim is event-oriented,
yes.
Or Maqtal al-Husayn is personally oriented, okay?
Yes. Okay.
And these books should be regarded as chronicles. For example,
yes.
In this year, such and such, for example, events took place. Or within this year, for example, in this season, this event took place, and
That's
so
right.
on. They go on in this way. At the same time, it must be indicated that one of the important points regarding Abu Mekhtaf is that he tried to interview either those who were available or either those who were present on the plain of Karbala or, for example, a person who was present in the time on the plain of Karbala, but he died,
okay?
Now, Abu Mekhtaf went to his elder son, okay?
Uh-huh.
Tell me what your father had told you regarding his experience in Karbala.
Okay.
And from this perspective, we find that
So reports, you mean? A kind of
yes,
but reports.
I should like to say that no. Abu Mekhtaf was, a person who had adopted much earlier than, Western scholars, research procedures. It was his adoption it was his, I should like to say that his sagacity, research sagacity, to have adopted an interview-based history or field research in this regard. So from this perspective, we can say that he was after finding, first-hand reports. But at the same time, some of these reports may sound not to be that much harmonious with each other, but he did his best in this regard.
That's all right. And was it in the shape of a book at the first look, or no, there were some papers here and there, and then,
some notes and papers.
The next generations changed it into in a revision form, an edition form into a book.
Yes, if you consider, for example, very important historical documents or even religious records, you find that, they can rarely be found to be in the form of several chapters or several paragraphs,
That's
whole
right.
text is continuous, and it's like a running on text,
Okay, that's all right.
These intertextual divisions should be, later developments, applied in the case of books.
That's
However,
right.
content-wise, it's believed that Abu Mekhtaf was amongst the earliest generations of those people who endeavored to come up with a history of what took place on Ashura.
That's all right, on the day of Ashura. I'll get back to you asking some questions about the main content. Now, Sheikh Mahtavi, so these are some, can I say, several reports that has to be gathered and then changed into a shape of the book. And the next generation of the scholars and ulama of the Shiite world, has changed it into a book called Al-Maqtal al-Husayn, isn't it?
Yes.
So talk a little bit about this authenticity of the reports in this book for us.
As I think briefly it was mentioned in our program so far, we have to come to this point that today we cannot say we have one authentic book which has been written by Abu Mekhnaf as Waqat al-Taf.
That's right.
Whatever we have right now is the piece of the documents and reports and records which is found in Tariq Tabari and Al-Irshad, the Sheikh Mufid.
Okay.
Two scholars, better to say scholars, because Tabari is mainly known as the historians who has been living during the 4th century. He passed away around, 310. So, mainly the things that we have regarding Maqtal Abu Mekhnaf is the records and reports that was gathered by Tabari in his book.
That's right.
Tarikh al-Rusul. The full name of his book is Tarikh al-Rusul wal-Muluk.
That's right.
And the other book that we can find some other reports and records in is the Al-Irshad, is written by Sheikh Mufid, the Shia scholar who living during the who passed away in 413.
You mean these two outstanding scholars, I mean At-Tabari and Sheikh Al-Mufid, we can say reported from Abu Mekhnaf, isn't it?
They had direct access to the
text.
Yes,
that's right.
Whatever today we know as Maqtal Abi Mekhnaf. So it's better to say what we are going to take and open and read and refer to as Maqtal Abi Mekhnaf today is not the same thing that has been gathered by Abi Mekhnaf himself.
That's right.
This is after one generation, and then they quote whatever they had in their access.
That's right.
I mean, Tabari and Sheikh Mufid.
Yes.
And today we have some of the authors, mainly in Farsi, as Mr. Gharavi. He gathered and compiled.
Yusufi Gharavi.
Yes,
right.
He compiled all things which are quoted from Maqtal Abi Mekhnaf in both books, Tabari and Al-Irshad, and he put it in the form of book.
So this is a comparative study, as you said, isn't it?
It could be said in one sense, not in a sense that it's kind of comparative studies that, okay, you are going to drop some sorts and then put some other sorts in your book.
Okay.
Just gather as much as possible from two sources, whatever which is quoted from Abu Mekhnaf.
That's all right. And Dr. Fakhwani, are there several, for example, Arabic revisions of the book available in the markets too about Abu Mekhnaf?
Yes.
You know, for his, what are they?
Yes, but in the beginning it must be indicated that the seminal contribution of Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Yusufi Gharavi lies in the fact that he has reconstructed Abu Mekhnaf's account.
Okay, how?
Yeah, I mean, as Mr. Mahdavi indicated, he, compared and contrasted, various versions of Tabari and Sheikh Mufid. I mean, Tabari's history book and, Sheikh Mufid's book, Kitab al-Irshad. And for the attention, for further information of the audience, I should like to mention that both of these books have been translated into English. I mean, Tabari's book was translated in several volumes published in America, if I'm not mistaken, by Columbia University, if I'm not mistaken. And Kitab al-Irshad was also published, translated into English from the Arabic original, and its translator was Jan Howard, who was a British scholar of Arabic literature, his translation, his English translation, was published in London in 1981, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
However, it must be indicated that, prior to, Muhammad Hadi Yusufi Gharavi's reconstructed account, there were several other Arabic versions, commonly known as Abu Mekhnaf. However, they had some discrepancies, at times, for example, this version was in stark difference from another version.
Yes.
And this was one of the impetus for Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Yusufi Gharavi to work out a reconstructed version of it. But for your information, I should like to say that, I mean, in lesser than 8 or 10 years ago, Imam al-Hussein's Holy Shrine, I mean, its publication, research and publication division, published a book in 3 volumes, Mawsu'at al-Maqatil al-Husayniya, Encyclopedia of Imam Hussein's Maqtals, Imam Hussein's martyrdom accounts. In this book, which is available in Arabic in 3 volumes, various accounts of martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are indicated. To my amazement, I found a version entitled The Maqtal, written by Al-Mujashi'i. Granted that there had been various versions of the same book bearing the title Abu Mekhnaf's account, what's important in this regard is that it shows that the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was really very, thought-provoking event, such that even in the harshest times of the Umayyad dynasty, and particularly Abbasid dynasty, some important historians devoted their energies to this case.
Right.
But at the same time, I should like to say that perhaps it was because of some historians who were, in fact, court historians, that they were able to reconstruct the event of Karbala in terms of some earlier generations of those people who taken part in the event. Other than this, I mean, from the point of the hadiths, we can rarely find any details about martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein al-Issa.
That's all right. And this is the role of the committed historians.
Yes.
To the history of Islam and the Shiite worlds, we can say, who dedicated their life in narrating the story, especially the story and the narrative of the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, called Maqtal al-Hussein, which are in different variations and different scholars. And inshallah, in our upcoming session, we'll dedicate the program, the teacher, to the other authors too, who spend their time. Thank you so much, Dr. Farhwani, for a nice elaboration. Sheikh Mahdavi, thank you so much. Brother, it was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, talking about Abu Mekhnaf, the author of Maqtal al-Hussein. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Daria Dugin, a journalist and prominent media personality sanctioned by the US and the UK, was massively pro-war, that she even wrote a book about it. But was she the target, or was her father? The two had been at a cultural festival together that afternoon. Alexander Dugin had given a lecture. Similar to many of his lectures, this one was no exception and was fully in line with his views. While many believe Dugin dreamt of a new Russian Empire, others said they heard echoes of these ideas during some of Russian president's speeches, including the one about Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. Saturday's incident was first witnessed by the world through unverified video footage showing Dugin at the scene of his daughter's death. Soon after, Russian Federal Security Service said the car bombing was orchestrated and carried out by Ukrainian secret services. Kiev has, on the other hand, denied the claim, saying it had nothing to do with the incident. But whether Ukraine was behind the attack or not, Russia is bound to respond to the true perpetrators of the attack, and the question remains, what kind of response can the world expect from Moscow?
Well, Russia's responses have been fairly targeted so far. They have a type of Iraq invasion in their military operations, but I believe that they will, based on their history of the last 6 months, probably respond by attacking some of the intelligence and military centers in Ukraine, perhaps in Kiev.
Saturday's bombing has left not only Russia but the world with many unanswered questions. The target is said to have been Dugin, known for his fiery rhetoric and hawkish anti-Western stance. Western media has painted him as a driving force behind key aspects of President Vladimir Putin's foreign policy. However, despite his reputation in the West, in Russia he has never enjoyed official endorsement from the Kremlin and is largely considered a marginal figure. Earlier on Saturday evening, Dugin was giving a lecture at a family festival on the outskirts of Moscow. Unconfirmed reports say Dugin initially planned to leave the festival with his daughter, who was also attending the event, but later decided to take a separate car while Daria took his car. But the question as to why he or his daughter was targeted using such drastic measures remains.
Well, Alexander Dugin is a philosopher who is also a Russian nationalist, and he has some internationalist views which coincide with many of Russia's allies these days. But his daughter also, Daria, let's not forget, was a journalist, a reporter with her own voice. She'd been in liberated Mariupol, for example. So it's not clear exactly, for example, whether Alexander was being targeted or Daria in her own right was being targeted, because apparently her car was targeted and that was not one that her father used. So it's a little difficult to say exactly what the motivation was, but they're clearly, from the gloating, from the glee, from US official sources, including Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, for example, and from many of the extremist Ukrainians, it's clear that they were very happy with this young woman being murdered by a terrorist bombing in Moscow.
It is widely believed that the war in Ukraine is causing a global food crisis. But how could this be true? Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of green essentials, like wheat and corn. But most of its products can't even leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
They are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. You know, Russia and other countries produce, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, you know, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa. It's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. You know, children are dying in Africa, Russian fault, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, you know, to the territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? He more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy. The impact of the West's war on Russia through sanctions can be felt globally. Global supply chains have been disrupted, fears of food shortages are rising, and countries' economies have also taken a hit. But despite the heavy costs incurred by the people worldwide, the US and many European leaders seem to have set their eyes on pushing ahead with their sanctions policy instead of opting for diplomacy. Russia is a major exporter of potash, ammonia, urea, and other soil nutrients, and the supply of all these fertilizers, which are necessities for efficient production of corn, soy, rice, and wheat, has been heavily disrupted as a result of Western sanctions on Russia. A clear example of this would be Brazilian farmers, who are forced to use less fertilizers considering the shortages created in their country. In some African countries, farmers are reverting to using manure to nourish their crops. And in North America, some farmers have stockpiled fertilizers for the 2023 season in anticipation of higher prices. Meanwhile, in the United States, fertilizer bills are expected to jump 12% this year, and that's according to the American Farm Bureau Federation and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA data.
No, I think the whole war is definitely, you know, war in general is, should be avoided. But this one is just very cynical calculation. Somehow the leadership of NATO, leadership in Washington, decided that it's a win-win situation. A, we, you know, get opinion against Russia. B, we'll get sanctions against Russia, which will benefit us, our gas companies, our oil companies, our military companies. And C, it even has a chance to weaken Russia, which is like our enemy, to weaken Russia militarily. So they're pumping Ukraine with the military forces. They're trying to push them to the battlefield. In the battlefield, Russians are killed, Ukrainians are killed in great numbers. While, you know, leadership, Ukrainian leadership buys fancy cars for themselves and send, and they don't send their children to the front. They send some poor people to the front. So this is just exercising the bloodshed, out of which many people hope to, you know, get some economic benefit.
But while standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. Instead of following diplomacy similar to Turkey in an attempt to solve the ongoing crisis, the West continues to follow its warmongering aspirations and further sanction Russia. The fall of the US dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there's a decline in the US standing as a superpower, there's also the harsh reality that the US is facing, the decline of the US dollar. All the signs are there. Shares of the US dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. The US, the most indebted nation ever, also has a sovereign debt crisis, another sign that it may be heading to a dollar collapse. The US use of the dollar as a weapon like sanctions has made other countries resist using it in their trade. Yet countries like Iran, Russia, and China are moving towards the elimination of the dollar altogether. This is why Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said, against the growing geopolitical pressure from the collective West, the only way to guarantee stable trade, economic and investment ties between Russia and its partners is to avoid the dollar and the euro and switch to settlements in acceptable alternatives, primarily in national currencies. His reference to the growing geopolitical pressure from the West are sanctions from the US and its European allies due to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. But these sanctions have been heavily used against Russia starting from the year 2014.
When it comes to trade, if you want to move away from the dollar, as you're supposed to say, Russian ruble, it's going to be very difficult indeed. Of course, you can trade in ruble and other currencies, but the key thing is you need them to be liquid. That's to say, easy to buy and sell and a decent size. And also the margin, or the difference between the buying and selling costs, all of this can make it more difficult. Therefore, if you're trading in dollars, the price is normally going to be sharper. If you're trading in, say, another currency, well, you may find it's illiquid, as barren as a desert, and not be able to complete your trade.
The de-dollarization move was thrown into fast gear when the US Treasury Department decided to confiscate Russia's dollar foreign exchange reserves. This made other countries think twice about holding their reserves in the dollar currency. After all, these countries have concluded that their country could be the next if it does not abide by US foreign policy. They can be a victim of secondary sanctions at a minimum. Therefore, it was a natural progression for countries like Russia, China, and Iran to trade with their own national currencies. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said that mechanisms for settlement in national currencies other than Western ones have been successfully created with a number of nations, and the possibility of paying in rubles for certain categories of Russian export goods, including energy and food products, has been set up.
It's going to be interesting to see actually what happens with the dollar now, because I suspect there's going to be quite a lot of weakness of it. Why? Well, because the global economy is slowing down for one key reason. But nonetheless, the dollar is normally seen as a safer haven than other currencies. So what you'll find is actually people will go to the dollar in times of emergency because they know it's actually got depth, liquidity, and obviously the treasury standing behind it. If you were using another currency, those things would not be as strong and it would not be as straightforward to be able to run a business like that.
The BRICS, SCO and other international platforms have intensified their multilateral discourse on the subject. And this is very significant since the US has fallen out of favor with many countries and are gravitating eastward or away from the US. Take the case of Brazil. Presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has recommended using a Latin American currency to be free of the US dollar. Lula has pledged many things that don't involve the US and the dollar, such as strengthening its relations with Latin America, vowing to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The BRICS have also been discussing the development of a BRICS pay multilateral wallet and currency.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinian's foreign ministry has censored the raid as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts